Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is June 2nd. This is the first Thursday of the month when we have special guest co-host Greg Glazer on. And due to some scheduling conflicts amongst all of the three people, including Alan Phillips, attorney at law, we have pre-recorded today's show. And therefore, we also had considerable number of technical glitches and sound problems, but hopefully you will be able to hear the majority of the show that we pre-recorded, and I'm going to play that for you now. There is a live chat. It is open if you wish to comment, and enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is June 2nd, 2011, and I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today. We also have Greg Glazer with us, a constitutional law expert. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and we have, we've reached over 20,000 listens on all of our shows this week, and that is very exciting, a number for us to have reached that milestone. And hopefully we will get this recording out so that more people can learn about their personal rights in the United States and what freedom is all about and the options that they have dealing with vaccinations in the United States and a number of other issues it can be extrapolated out to. There are a lot of things happening today. And I'm going to let Greg and Alan try and introduce to us the main things, topics of today. So why don't you tell us what we have in store for the hour?
Okay. I can get started, Debbie. Our show agenda today is going to be about the division of authority between federal and state government in emergency response measures. And essentially what we're going to be examining there is when do federal agencies have the power to enforce their regulations in regards to vaccines in a pandemic versus when do state governments have that power? And then where do individual rights fit in? And this is going to raise issues of constitutional separation of powers among the different branches of government. And then we'll close with the legal definitions that surround the pandemic and outbreak and what constitutes a triggering event and how different triggering events can affect who has the authority among federal and state government in emergency response measures. So that's our show agenda. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Alan?
That sounds great to me, Greg. I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say, in particular about what really is local or state or federal authority and how that shifts or mixes or what have you. Because when the pandemic was playing out, the swine flu pandemic in late 2009 and 2010, there was a lot of gossip on the internet in vaccine circles, alternative vaccine circles, and a lot of confusion about this. Could the federal government or the World Health Organization declare an emergency and require that everybody be vaccinated? And if so, under what conditions? And there was a lot of concern about that. So I'm looking forward to diving into this and getting hopefully some clarification.
Oh yeah. And,
right, and I'm interested in learning about what the state, as opposed to the federal portion of the government, has control over.
You know, we all have a very deep and vested interest in the issue of mandatory vaccination because it affects our natural bodies. And the idea that any government agency can come and forcefully vaccinate us is just a scary thought. And then when we also think about them forcefully vaccinating our child, you know, that's when it can really strike to the core of the individual rights issue. And in history, when this has happened, when governments have tried to do mandatory quarantines and mandatory health measures, sometimes, as we've seen in the past, public officials have been just outright shot, and they had to call off the response measures. I mean, these were situations that happened a very long time ago, over 100 years ago, but that's our precedent. And today, we have come into a place where there are so many different agencies involved, both at the state level, the federal level, and the international level. It is very challenging to discern exactly who has the power. And I don't say that because it is so complicated as to be beyond the mind of a constitutional scholar, but rather constitutional scholars are saying, look, we've read the regulations coming from all the camps, and it's just uncertain. And so if we were to add Lawrence Gostin had noted that in one of his papers, where he was saying that it's called Through the Quarantine Looking Glass.
Through the Quarantine Looking Glass, like Alice in Wonderland?
yeah, that's right. And Lawrence Gostin happens to work for it's in Maryland. It's one of the John Hopkins. It's like it's a university that's sort of a cover for the bioterrorism military industrial complex. So you wouldn't know. I mean, on the outside, he looks like a legal scholar, but actually works for the military. And
how do you spell his last name?
Yeah. And he commonly writes with a guy named David Fidler, and here it is straight from the horse's mouth. When it comes to the exercise of isolation and quarantine powers, reality tends to be messier than the conceptual realm. Public health officials need clear lines of authority in emergency situations, often the moments when isolation and quarantine might be required. Unfortunately, confusion about which level of government should take the lead often occurs, thus revealing the ability of quarantine powers to spotlight difficulties federalism poses for public health. So right there in that quote, we have it from the basically the number one authority, according to the government, that it's uncertain as to where the federalism line is. And when I say federalism, that's going to have a lot of different meanings today. Federalism in its traditional constitutional sense meant the powers given to Congress under Article 1, Section 8, the enumerated powers, which include, you know, the right to regulate interstate commerce, the right to declare war, and it also included the rights to the responsibilities given to federal courts, you know, in matters involving two states, for example, and also powers given to the executive. And federalism has changed in scope over the years because the Supreme Court and lower courts have interpreted the federal powers to be incredibly expansive today and have limited states' rights and also individual liberty. And this is often a flag-raising issue for a lot of states' rights folks, but what they don't realize oftentimes is that the states are often no better and are sometimes worse than the federal government in restricting individual liberty. So to lead the charge on states' rights isn't actually going to solve this problem here. Nor is it going to solve the problem going the other way, to look to the international community for the protection of individual liberty. Because at the international level, we have the World Health Organization leading the charge for mandatory vaccination. So basically, you have state governments enacting their own pandemic laws that are ambiguous enough to allow mandatory vaccination if it were going to ultimately, excuse me, on just 1 second, I should turn off my phone call here. Okay, so at the state level, you have these statutes that are passed that will essentially they're cooperation agreements between state and federal government so that states will bring their pandemic laws into harmony with the Model Act. And at the federal level, you have agencies that will cooperate with one another. Also, these are called cooperation agreements or memorandums of understanding. And they will delegate authority amongst the different branches of the federal government to enforce these pandemic laws. So perhaps one of the first questions that we might ask in this sort of sea of ambiguity as to who exactly has the power is what is a triggering event for a pandemic. And so essentially the first place to begin might be at the top. So, and then we might say the very top would be the international community, the World Health Organization. And they recently changed their rule as to what's defined as a pandemic. This was in 2009. It's just a disease that's new to a population or hasn't surfaced in a long time and caused by disease-causing agents that can cause serious illness and can be easily spread among humans. Now, it used to be that there had to be a high morbidity and high mortality rate, but they took that out. So that's why we saw the H1N1 flu pandemic. You know, it didn't really hurt many people, did it? You know? And yet it was still called a pandemic because they took out this concept that there had to be high morbidity or high mortality. And so the triggering event is much smaller today for when a pandemic is declared. And once a pandemic is declared, then it triggers all these different laws will go into effect. Now, when the United States signed on to the what was the act?
To the international government.
That's right. It was the IHR. This is the
International Health Regulations.
Yeah, exactly. From 2005, from the World Health Assembly. And what the United States did when we accepted the IHR is we did it with three reservations. We said that, the main one is that the United States will only agree to abide by World Health Organization regulations which are in line with U.S. principles of federalism. So here we are, we've come full circle now to this concept of federalism. And these IHR regulations are so important because they essentially give designated national points of contact, which means that the president essentially will get to implement the World Health Organization regulation. So it's not going to go to the individual states. They go directly to the national point of contact. And then because our states, like California doesn't sign on with the WHO, it's the United States that signs on. And then they give definitions of public health capacities, disease control measures such as quarantine and border control and others. And then once these guidelines come down, and the WHO is very direct that they're not limiting their authority and saying that forced vaccination is not on the table. They have to use the least restrictive means to contain and protect the public health. So if somebody doesn't want to get vaccinated, it may be that they can be isolated, which would mean, I guess, imprisoned in their own separate compound, in their own separate cell. But it may mean that they do forced vaccinations, whatever they decide is the least restrictive means. And at that point, you look to your recourse, which would be the courts in that process. But it would all be implemented by the United States. So essentially, when the United States agrees to become a member of the WHO and it agrees to these guidelines, these IHR guidelines, it's saying that that the United States police, the executive, the United States government, will enforce these regulations. So that's how it would come down. It would come down to the Center for Disease Control and the HHS, Health and Human Services Agency. And we know from their own writings, and we go back to the guys that I was just citing, Fidler and Gostin, and the other attorneys who write for the Congressional Research Service, when they write about the powers here, and in no uncertain terms, they state that mandatory vaccination is the law in the United States. And in order to support that claim, they cite the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts, and we devoted a whole show, a whole radio program about a couple months ago just to talk about that case. And the point that I made when we talked about that case in great detail was that it really protects individual liberty on so many levels, and it had to be limited in scope, and yet here's this classic example where if you give these federal agencies a little bit of power, it will grow into more, and that's what we've seen. So we've seen these omnibus pandemic laws where, in reality, people are not going to know exactly what applies, whether it's the National Emergencies Act or the Stafford Act or the FFDCA, and because you go into these laws and they seem to have overarching aspects of their authority and the power.
Swine flu pandemic where
an individual county declared an emergency for that county. We had 11 states and District of Columbia and I think American Samoa all declaring swine flu emergencies, which opened the door in each of those instances for those states for vaccines to be mandated. What we saw was a very limited exercise of that authority. New York temporarily mandated swine flu vaccines for healthcare professionals. And then that was fairly quickly withdrawn. But I just wanted to add that it appears that, and maybe this varies from state to state, but at least in some states, that even individual local authorities, probably individual counties or equivalent, are authorized to, or departments of health within individual counties may be authorized to declare emergencies for their counties. And so we have levels of authority ranging from local to all the way up to international. And I think I just want to repeat or underscore one of the points you made. If I'm restating this correctly, let me know or clarify by all means if you feel I'm not getting this right. But I think it's sort of a starting point, at least in my own analysis. I look for these sort of technical lines of authority where we could look for some legal authority or some source to tell us that here are some clear lines. And yet I think what I hear you saying that is that either these lines really aren't so clear, or perhaps even if they are clear as sort of a technical analytical matter, that as a matter of practical reality, there may be some blurring of these lines or even overstepping of boundaries or confusion about where the boundaries are. What concerns me about that whole issue or question is that this is a situation where we don't want to be in the position of some boundaries in a significant way with some adverse effects, some boundaries having been crossed, and then looking back at some terrible event and then analyzing it retrospectively and then saying, aha, you crossed a boundary, that's why this harm was caused, now who's going to, be accountable for that? We want, ideally, to be able to define lines or identify lines in such a way to do this prospectively so that we hopefully avoid for example, having a vaccine crammed down our throat, so to speak. One of the things, again, I saw a lot in the swine flu pandemic, and then just generally with my clients or people in the alternative vaccine community and internet conversations, people will often have a real clear kind of gut feeling or sense about we have such and such a right or should have such and such a right. But it turns out sometimes you can back that up with legal authority, but other times it's not. A lot of times what people think should be their right turns out to not necessarily really be a right. And so that brings us, as a quick side note here, brings us to a point that I keep repeating over and over again, that it's important for us, to the best of our abilities, to understand and get clear about what our rights are in a lot of different situations and contexts. And when we don't like the answer, we need to become legislatively proactive to request or demand of our state and federal representatives that those boundaries be expanded to some level that is appropriate under the circumstances. Go ahead, please.
You want me to jump in here? All of this makes me think that the local firemen, when they do test drills, whenever they need to be prepared to know that they can get in there in an emergency event and put out a fire. And so they even in the school buildings, they have fire drills. So I think, like, the government, is there such a thing for the government to have a run-through to see if a program works? Even in a computer, you test to see whether it's working and you get the bugs out, and so that when you actually need to use something, it functions properly. And in the same way, shouldn't we do something in relationship to the government and how it works? Is there ever such a thing as what I'm talking about?
I don't have a clear answer to that, but I know in general that there are drills and run-throughs for infectious disease emergencies, for bioterrorist attack, and there are plans that have been developed at the state and federal level. And I'm sure at both levels they do from time to time drills or run-throughs. It's difficult, I think, to anticipate in full the range of hypothetical possibilities in terms of being prepared for everything out there. But, you know, to the degree that we're mindful of hypothetical possibilities, sure, plans are put in place and developed over time, and drills of one kind or another enacted. But that's an ongoing process. To what extent at any point in time any particular local, state, or federal or international authority is prepared for any particular situation, you know, that's just going to vary.
You know what it is? I think that the movie theaters are doing it for us. You know, Apocalypse Now and whatever, you know, alien invasion and whatever it is, they kind of give us a futuristic look at what could possibly happen, what are the possible scenarios, and how will people emotionally react, and what is the response of the government or the CDC or the WHO to come in and act. And we see it in front of our eyes. But the question is, which of those scenarios is actually the one that's going to happen, and what are we going to do to save ourselves? Because there's always a hero in every movie.
Well, I think part of the difficulty is what Greg has already been talking about, is that to the extent that there is in any given emergency situation either a lack of clarity, and that could be on any number of people's parts from any of the different levels of authority that we're talking about here, there's the potential for a lack of efficiency in responding properly to the situation. If it, at minimum, a delay in government acting while they try to figure out who's in charge. Yeah, I mean, I think my understanding is that traditionally that public health has been seen as a state issue, primarily a state issue. And that's, for example, with vaccines, the federal government can't enact laws requiring vaccines for state residents. So the CDC and the ACIP make recommendations, and states will generally enact those recommendations into law. But there are differences from state to state, in vaccine requirements. They're not all the same, even though the CDC has one set of recommendations that's updated periodically, of course. And, of course, we see a broad range of variation in exemptions laws as well. Probably most states do, as Greg was saying, have the authority to mandate vaccines if they declare an emergency. And frankly, to throw exemptions out the window, I've even seen medical exemptions thrown out the window, which is most perplexing to me given Jacobson, because that seemed to me to say that a medical exemption would be an option even in an emergency situation if there's a severe enough medical basis for objecting to vaccines, an emergency.
There's a lot of things that are actually happening right now that are testing the waters. I just received a message from someone, and you know, Mike Adams of Natural News, he is the go-to person. He's out there. He is calling Marianne Godboldo for healthcare freedom, that, you know, her child was being forced to be medicated. And he is ranting and raving. Mike is really going off the deep end about calling the United States government corporate fascism to chemically enslave all peoples and people of color. That is how far he's going, because he is really, I'm calling him a zealot in my own little blog here, because I think that he's very upset that the rights of individuals have been totally taken away for caring for families and defending her against what they did is they kidnapped her child, is what he's saying, because they took the child away from her authority. And did you guys see this?
No.
Well, it's a real interesting point in what it has to say about the larger vaccine issue specifically, and then it boils down to this, that I have argued that government necessarily does need to have the authority to intervene in an emergency for the health and well-being of its citizens. But the question for me is not whether or not government should have that authority, but where should the lines be and who gets to draw those lines? And what we have going on in our government today is that
they redrew the lines, basically. Alan, when you hear what Greg just said, when they redefined what is a pandemic, which has been in established language for how many years, and they redrew the line. They gave themselves broader...
And this is exactly my point, that we have a situation where industry has infiltrated government at all levels in a manner and to a degree where the actions of government can no longer reliably be said to be consistently objective and in the best interest of the constituency. And this is really a very serious problem. That's a very serious charge, but I have been looking at this issue for years. I have mounds of evidence in the articles I've written. I give cites to all of this. And the World Health Organization and this pandemic is a really classic example of this, Debbie, that, as you mentioned, they changed the definition. When they changed the definition, that triggered contract clauses around the world for the sale of $18 billion worth of emergency vaccines, swine flu vaccines, the overwhelming majority of which were never administered. But they delivered them and got paid for them anyway. And you have to ask. Now, as reputable an entity, and in this case a publication, as the British Medical Journal, the editor of the British Medical Journal was very critical of the WHO in its mishandling of the pandemic, going so far as to say that the leadership of the WHO may need to resign in order for integrity to be maintained. Now, the World Health Organization itself has just recently come out with reports saying there wasn't any mishandling. We've investigated this ourselves. So when the foxes investigate themselves, there's never any problem with the hen house, you know, and the way the hen house was managed.
Right.
But for some strange reason, when these authorities, who are the quote-unquote authorities, make a statement, however conflicted it may be, however self-serving, it somehow manages to stick. I mean, you can't get much more mainstream authority than the British Medical Journal. That is a nationally, internationally recognized leading medical publication. And I just saw recently a quote from a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a Dr. Marcia Engel. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, but with Harvard Medical School, and for 20 years was an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and she came out about 3 years ago with a statement saying that she has very reluctantly had to acknowledge, based on her experience, that we can no longer rely on medical journals, on their studies, on the traditional standard medical authorities. She's published one or more books herself on these problems and read and commented on other books published on the problem, and it's a deep, complex, and involved topic, but in essence, it involves the infiltration of industry into what perhaps was initially and pretends to still be objective scientific research, when in fact that's not at all what's going on much of the time. And it's industry looking out for itself, and to the detriment of people, of citizens, of people who aren't aware that that's going on, of people, including many, many doctors who rely on journals and diagnose and prescribe based on the published studies. Well, when there's maybe one or two studies that have a favorable reading, and then there's a dozen or two dozen studies that were not favorable, and the journal can make more money by publishing the one or two favorable studies and not publishing any of the unfavorable studies, how does a doctor get any kind of genuine or objective information? So it's not as if there's this huge conspiracy involving hundreds of thousands of medical doctors. There's a much smaller conspiracy in terms of the number of people who are directly aware of what's going on and either passively or actively involved with that.
Well, you know, there's so many really overlying layers to this, to these issues. The layers being, what is the truth, and is our information viable? Is it objective? Who is providing this information to the authorities? That's one layer and level. But the other thing that, you know, why I really depend upon Greg is to tell us how we know, it's sort of like a dance between the different levels of government, county, state, federal, national, international. How do we make the adjustments so that we can see clear enough lines to know who is going to be in charge and who is going to make the right decisions for the safety of and provide the rights of citizens when a pandemic or a triggering event is declared? That's what I really want to know from Greg. I mean, what kind of historical references can we use besides the Jacobson one to know what to do in these instances?
Sure. Yeah. The traditional police power provided the authority in local governments to issue health regulations, which would include quarantine and health measures, and up to vaccination. And that authority was always based on triggering events that were local in character, except when it occurred at a port, in which case you would have federal regulation, because that's one of the powers given in the Constitution. Is to regulate commerce, including on the high seas. And so, and even then, even when it didn't happen at a port, in the early days of the Republic, it would still be controlled by the state because they had more resources. Now, today, your typical triggering event for a pandemic or contagion is not going to be like some virus that starts in an apple orchard, you know? It's far more likely to be something wider in scope and therefore interstate in character or related to terrorism. And so in both of those cases, whether it's interstate or related to terrorism, they're going to be the triggering event triggers federal authority. And so even though the traditional power is vested in the state to provide for containment, quarantine, vaccination, the federal government can quickly usurp that police power on a national level by these categories. So it's just about the classification. This is why one of our topics for today is just definition. Even the Congressional Research Service today writes about how many of these laws, which relate to forced vaccination and quarantine and public health measures, many of these laws come out of the Commerce Clause. And for those of us who've studied the Commerce Clause, it comes from Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. It says that the Congress of the United States has the power to regulate interstate commerce. Now, what does that have to do with forced vaccination? You know, but that's what these laws are passed under. And now that's just sort of to set up the infrastructure so that if there were a so that you can have.
Can I make a comment on that? The Congress has a right to regulate interstate commerce. Well, we know that a lot of problems come into the United States via these vehicles, these vectors, like bugs and snakes and germs and things that come in on fruit, on living organisms, on even on humans, on people, so contagious diseases. So that makes sense in a way that they're regulating this, and they have to oversee and inspect what is coming into the country. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Alan. Go for it.
Excuse me for jumping in. I just want to add a little more, hopefully a little more clarification that in theory, an event that would be wholly contained within a single state would be a public health event, would be something beyond the reach of the federal government. But I just wanted to point out a document I was reading just a little while ago, which was looking at assessing SARS, was pointing out that the federal government, by way of interstate commerce, the Commerce Clause, could have authority, arguably, to reach into a state if it involved people who were about to move to another state, or they had reason to believe that they had exposed other people who were moving interstate. So we're a much more mobile society today than we were 100 years ago or a couple hundred years ago, and it would be much easier, I think, for the federal government to argue that any given individual or people that individual had come in contact with were likely or probable to be moving interstate. But maybe for, again, just for purposes of clarification, that there are, as a starting point only, but as a starting point, there are certain jurisdictions that are by definition.
Hello?
International.
Repeat yourself because I lost sound. As a starting point, certain jurisdictions what?
There are some authority and jurisdiction by definition that we could talk about briefly as a starting point, just again for some clarification or as a base to build from. So, for example, anything that involves coming into the country from another country is by definition a federal concern, even if it comes into only one state. U.S. airspace is a federal jurisdiction. So even if you're just flying from between two cities in the same state, when you're in the air on an airplane, you're in a federal jurisdiction. If you're traveling between states, that can make something that's purely a state issue, can turn it into a federal issue. So those are some of the primary arenas where you can make a distinction between whether, at least as a start, like something is a state issue or a federal issue. Now, if you have something involving between countries, let's say crossing the border between the U.S. and Mexico, as opposed to, I guess, coming into port from an ocean, that probably is something that by definition would trigger World Health Organization jurisdiction. But as we've been talking about, those lines can quickly blur either because of the particular circumstance or situation, and maybe there's some lack of clarity just in the law as a starting place, some of the definitions or some of the assertions or statements in law. But also that to one degree or another, any of these different levels can invite or request the involvement of other levels. And so even if there is a clear boundary with any given event as a starting place, the boundary can quickly dissolve or become blurred depending on the actions of the initial authority.
Shouldn't our Constitution provide the guidelines for any event that we could handle it? It just seems strange. I think that the Founding Fathers were pretty brilliant in what they provided for us up until this point.
And well, I'd love to comment on that and to hear what Greg would say on it as well.
Okay.
I'll squeeze in something real quick here, Greg, and then turn that over to you. But I think our legal system, our laws, in one sense, sets out to do something that is just not possible. And it has, as part of the system, a built-in mechanism to deal with that. But what I mean by that is this, that a hypothetically ideal legal system would be one that could prescribe laws or rules or boundaries for what in our reality is, and by definition, a hypothetically infinite variety of future situations. Hypothetically, I mean, there's an infinite, a potentially infinite variety of future circumstances can arise. So when you think of it that way, it's really impossible for our legal system to anticipate all that. So the legal system is built in such a way that allows us to evolve the system itself, to evolve or modify in an ongoing process to try and keep up with the changes in society that couldn't be anticipated or weren't anticipated, for example. And one of the ways it does that is with legal precedent. Sometimes you have a law that seems perfectly reasonable in the way it's worded or stated when it's enacted, but then a situation comes up that you didn't anticipate, and it's like, wow, how does the law apply to this situation, or does it even apply at all? And there might be reasonable arguments for two or more different answers to that question. And so you put it in front of a judge, you look at the closest related legal precedent that you have, you look at public policy and other factors, and you try to make a decision that's fair and consistent with our law up to this point. But oftentimes courts are faced with what they call a case of first impression. Wow, we've never seen this before, and they have to figure out what to do with it. Now, they don't make arbitrary decisions, or at least we hope they don't, and the system is not designed to allow for arbitrary decisions. But if it is a case of first impression, they've got to come up with a way to resolve that. But once they resolve that particular case, there then is a point of reference in the law. But, you know, the efficiency of that system could be questioned at times, because in some jurisdictions, it seems like the law is evolving rapidly to keep up with evolving society, and other times not so much so. But Greg, what do you have to share and shed some light on that issue with us?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's see here. The white slave-holding racist.
Speak up a little bit. I'm losing you.
The men who wrote the Constitution were white, slave-holding, land-owning racists, and they wrote a document that was very vague, and it's evolved over time, and it's been stewarded now by the legal machine that churns out what they want to accomplish. When I read the Commerce Clause decisions where they say that a guy raising chickens in his backyard affects interstate commerce, you know, or when I read a case that says that a rice paddy is a navigable water of the United States, I'm realizing these guys are doing whatever they want to do. You know, it's not like this is intelligent stuff that's being discussed. It's like they have an outcome they're going to achieve, and they get there.
But it doesn't sound any different than living today?
Yeah. I think that the United States has never been a real republic. It's never been fair. There's always been war and oppression and resource domination, and it's just shifted in various degrees. And I think earlier we were talking about some very heavy and interesting stuff about the military-industrial complex and its scope. And for those interested in reading more about that, I'd recommend the writings of Leonard Horowitz, who really goes into what are the agendas behind what's happening, or the writings of G. Edward Griffin. You know, when we live in a world where they are using chemtrails in the skies, dropping chemicals upon us, fluoridating the water, considering these mandatory vaccination programs and stuff. I mean, tipping bullets with depleted uranium.
What are they doing? They're putting what?
They're putting radioactive uranium in bullets.
So, they are?
It's called depleted uranium, and sort of a misnomer because it's hardly depleted. It's very strong. And it's been shot into foreign countries in United States wars for the last who knows how long, but it was really popularized in the original Gulf War. That there was just a massive amount. I forget the exact tonnage that was dropped there, but
well, we don't have to worry. We're all being irradiated now from Fukushima nuclear meltdown.
Nice.
We're save your money. Don't buy those bullets.
Yeah, I mean, and it's meant, so the greater theme here, and it's been well summarized by G. Edward Griffin, is that the powers that be will tell us that they are protecting us. They'll tell us while they're killing us. And it's always in our best interest. You know, these global warming regulations, they're meant to save the world. These pandemic rules, they're meant to protect public safety. You know, really, they're injecting poison in you. You know, when they say that they're spraying the skies with metal in order to prevent global warming.
Mm-hmm. What are they doing?
You know, fluoridating water to promote healthy teeth.
Right.
They've done tests about fluoride showing that it reduces the energy levels of people and is very harmful to you.
Well, I have to tell you, the recent news on the media, I'm really enlightened and heartened to hear that they're talking about the cell phones as causing brain cancer gliomas. They're finally, after how many years, 10 years or more, where they've already had the information. I know that there are famous homeopathic physicians in India who have been treating these gliomas, and people like Manfred Mueller who have talked about staying away from cell phones and not having them because of the damage. And now, finally, the mainstream media is actually warning the public. So what do we think of this? New warnings.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of surface-level amount of debate that can occur. Like society itself has these deep-rooted diseases, and it's around these things that we've been talking about. Chemtrails, crime, corruption, depleted uranium, resource consolidation, and all this stuff. And then around that, there's all these symptoms. It's things like cell phone radiation would be a classic. Like, it's so small in the scheme of things as to the underlying diseases in the world that it's wonderful to encourage debate and interest in it because, everyone's got a cell phone.
So you're saying it's deflecting from the real much broader, deeper issues that are affecting the populations by allowing a little bit of information to appear as if you're actually getting some truth.
Yes. People love to debate what they know. You know, people love to debate Republican, Democrat because it's what they know, even though neither entity really is the particularly, I want to say relevant. Obviously, they're relevant in the sense that they're huge. But isn't any type of solution. You know, in a sense, they're both the same thing. It's this false dichotomy relationship that's happening. So, and that's why I know any candidate who runs for president or any candidate who runs for any high office in particular, who isn't talking about like purging society of these military, industrial, healthcare complex issues, or totally overhauling the monetary system, And if they use the word change, it's meaningless. It's just superficial. I know it because in order to...
I've heard somebody say that. I've heard somebody use the word change.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, essentially, to bring it full circle here, vaccines are part of this greater conspiracy for, in what I think, according to what my research shows, is a conspiracy for world domination, the conspiracy for power. And power and energy and focus, these are great concepts in homeopathy and in naturopathic medicine. And when applied to these macroeconomic industries and war games, we see just this saga, this tragedy unfolding before our eyes as power is misused and the zeal for undeserved power is so prominent. And we'll even see well-meaning people who work within these industries, and they only do it for their paycheck. And it's sad. You know, people who even know about what's going on, or they kind of have a hint of it. Maybe they don't know all the details in a particular category versus other categories, but they want to change, but they just feel like it's a lost cause in some sense. Or, you know, like, you'll see someone who will invest maybe like a whole week researching conspiracy theories, and they get totally excited about it and thinking, wow, there's this amazing thing. I'm really going to make some changes in my life. Talk to that person in a month, and they just are like right back into the same modus of behavior because they lack the tools to change. And so I think when
it certainly seems overwhelming. You know, I can say that with the vaccine issue, for example, that I've been involved in it for and learning about it for about 17 years at this point, 17 and a half years maybe, and I can honestly say that the deeper I dig, the messier it gets, and the larger I realize the issue is, in the sense that it goes well beyond just vaccines or just healthcare, that there's industry infiltration and control at all levels of government, and healthcare is only part of that. And so I concur with the picture you paint. I do say, would add to that briefly, and if this is naive, so be it, but I think there is truly a mixture of good and bad, to put it in really simplistic terms, battling and playing out. And some of what, for example, the Union of Concerned Scientists did a survey of federal agency scientists back in 2005, published it, and we talked about that on this show last week some, that many federal scientists were acknowledging that their research was being suppressed, or they were asked to change the outcomes or policy implemented directly contrary to their research. So, you know, it's the people in the policy-making, decision-making positions, and not all the federal agency scientists who are contributing to the problem, to the extent that they have some other agenda that influences what they do, the policy they enact or recommend. So I think there's a lot of people out there fighting. I think there clearly are, from the examples you gave, some very questionable court decisions historically where it seems really clear that somebody had an agenda and then they were going to do whatever rationale they needed to do to get there. But I also think there are some court decisions out there that really do try to be consistent and appropriate ethically and idealistically, adhering to the spirit and law of the Constitution and other laws. So I think it's a real curious jumble, but there's no question in my mind, and apparently yours as well, Greg, that there are some people wielding some pretty strong influence over policy and law for reasons that are clearly something other than putting first and foremost the well-being of constituency. So it's a serious issue, but it's easy to feel overwhelmed when you look at the scope. We begin to realize the depth and scope of this. What can we do short of, I think I've come to the conclusion that capitalism doesn't work. We need a completely different structure. As long as there's money attached to it, we're not going to be able to regulate our way out of the problems, in my own personal opinion. But what do you think we can do or should be doing now, Greg, given what you've described as sort of the general condition here?
Yes, I think that free markets do work well, but only in conjunction with law and order. And today what we have is special interest law, where the the lobbies will write and regulate their own industries. And so if you actually paid for the cost of a tomato, or if you actually paid for the cost of a bicycle, then over time that pollution would be incorporated and balanced out. But that's not what we have. We have a system where there's just like a toleration of what happens. And so in America, this free market model without the environmental regulation has resulted in more chemicals and toxins that are being produced in our products and in our industry just generally than can be tracked in any realistic sense.
Right, because we're not paying for the real cost of any of these products. The real health, the long-term health care cost and environmental cost. I mean, a glass of water would cost $8. Somebody just told me they came back from London and they thought, oh, everything they charged. She said that she went to a hotel with her dad and it was very expensive, but you didn't get anything. You had to go down to the main office and say, there's an extra fee for the TV. There's an extra fee for the phone. There's an extra fee for to put the air conditioning on, because otherwise you just open your window. And then she said she went to a restaurant and she thought, oh, I'll just get a glass of water. Well, it was $8. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's a classic example. I mean, if we had a model Earth where it was a clean environment and people were generally benevolent, you could have some really freedom-oriented laws. And, you know, you'd set up a system of very simple riparian rights for water. You'd set up very basic free market principles. But instead, what we have today is a very polluted planet with an incredibly diverse ownership structure that cannot be easily shifted. And so when we're talking about solution, I think that it begins with redoing the monetary supply, where it's run by state governments, but also it's open ended, so anyone can actually make their own money.
Who can make their own money?
Well, I mean that any organization can print money.
Yeah.
And then it would allow for competition in money, and so by freeing the world from a consolidated financial system or central banks, if you like, then you have a more open and elastic monetary supply that will begin to empower people. And by involving states in it, you can actually take advantage of the massive consolidation of resources that states have or that national governments have. You know,
feel that as long as one's profit interests are inconsistent with the health and well-being of themselves or others, as long as there's that conflict or tension, that human nature is such that whatever rules you put in place, people will push the boundaries, will violate rules ultimately to the extent they can get away with it. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has anywhere in the order of $1 to $3 billion of criminal and civil fines every year. And many of those are criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Obviously, the only reason they keep doing that over and over again is because, on the whole, it's profitable for them to do that. And so with that as an example, again, as long as there is a conflict between one's profit interest and the health and well-being of citizens, I don't think the system ultimately can work. That's why I just, again, have come to the conclusion that I don't think capitalism works.
I think capitalism has never been tried.
Capitalism as we have known it clearly doesn't work. I'll put it like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if we include capitalism as the absence of law and order, then yeah, I'd agree. But I think that the law and order structure, when it works, is just beautiful. But when it doesn't, and we don't have prosecutions taking place, for example, you know, the start of war games and behind the scenes assassinations and these amazing programs that are happening behind the scenes with technology, these black ops, you might call them.
What are they called? Black what?
Black operations, black ops. like underground bases, secret technologies, and things of that nature, or un-nature.
I don't know how many people know about this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think what, you know, which brings me to the second thing we need to do is have full transparency in government. I'd like to see a return for most people to a more, I guess, Native American type of lifestyle. That would help be like a great welfare program to kind of get back into a transition. I think ultimately to restore society to a more holistic level, it would take decades. And this is just in theory. I have no realistic hope that this is going to happen. But, yeah, it would take decades.
You know what?
Just to make a dent in it.
Yeah. After listening to the both of you, it sounds like, number one, very hopeless. That why even bother? Because we have no control over what's happening. And in the linear time, we're going to be going forward. I don't feel like we can go backward to American, Native American lifestyle, which whatever that was in your mind. And so if we're going forward, do we have any hope at all?
Well, we have technology, and that was the balance. Is that I said Native American lifestyle for most people, but who's going to recycle the cars? Who's going to manage the nuclear plant? So we have technology, we have cleanup jobs to do, and so eventually we sort of gradually get into a more sustainable lifestyle. And so it begins with money and changing the monetary supply and system, and putting in place the structures for environmental cleanup, and just hoping that people will live in a more sustainable manner and sort of get off of this idea, this culture that's unworkable. Now, is that realistic? No, but maybe we're living in a tragedy. You know, did Hamlet give up at the end? Did he just, you know, give up his sword fight? You know, no. I mean, think about all of the great things, you know, all the great films you watch, all the great plays, you know, the great songs. It's about this debate. So no, I mean, don't give up and lie down. You know, yes, every person who's ever lived in history has died, but something has lived on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think clearly a part of this is raising awareness, and ultimately enough people have to stand together and stand out and speak in a unified voice, objecting to the corruption and conflicts of interest that are so widespread in our society, throughout all levels of government, and demand that change. And yes, absent some sort of radical intervening event, that probably is something that will not occur quickly. But as I often say, with regard to vaccines and even the larger issues here, failure really is not an option. We're either going to, you know, these are profound times, and we're on the verge of potentially irreparable harm and damage to ourselves as individuals, to vaccines and other things, and to our planet through pollution. And we are the generation that turns this around, or we may reach a point of no return. This is a very exciting time to be alive in that regard. And so it has yet to be seen how it's going to play out, of course. But there's no rock around with my name on it that's big enough for me to crawl under it. So I've decided to go forward and do what I can. Now, I've picked vaccines for whatever combination of reasons. There's any number of issues of equal or perhaps greater importance. But this is one of the big ones, and that's what I do. And I am so glad to have the two of you as peers and partners in this work. It's just tremendous. And boy, Greg, to have your keen intellectual insight and additions to this weekly show on a once-a-month basis has just been wonderful, and I really look forward to, you know, having this continue. I'm learning a tremendous amount.
We're at the end of the show, and I think that was a very appropriate ending, Alan, because I wasn't feeling very positive about the ability of humanity to improve on the road that we've been taking, that there are such monopolies and higher powers and corruption and all of the negative things that you can talk about, I mean, things that I don't even know about, black op, whatever that is, and chemtrails, and you name it. It's almost too much for one individual to take in. And what we need are educated persons who have the ability to speak clearly and legally and with authority against those ruling bodies. People like Mike Adams, people like the both of you who write letters and make it so that they can't push the edges over what they should be doing. So that's where I stand, and we are at the end of the show. Greg, do you want to say a final word on that?
Well, I'm glad to stand as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I would say that there's an optimism that can be found just in the journey. I think that if we try to focus on the result, you kind of know, you know, like if a tsunami is coming right at you, you kind of know. I mean, you don't want to really be kidding yourself at that point. Sometimes it's just time to man up and say, all right, this is what's coming toward me. What was my life about? What was the purpose here? And tragedies happen. And the powers here are so forceful that, you know, I think maybe the we can always just try to be individual and natural and organic in our own lifestyles and try to make smart decisions, and then at the end of the day, whatever happens to you happens, but hey, you know, at least you did that, and that's part of the fun journey.
Okay. All right, that's the end of the show then, and we will see you, Greg, in a month from now, the first Thursday of each month, and next Thursday, Alan. We will be back again on many fronts, talking about what you're doing out there in the field with your bow and arrow or whatever it is, your pen, your pen and paper, and that's it, folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Girl, one by one we are.